This is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
Like songbirds won't call, and when you want me, like I want you, I won't want another thing at all. No, no, I won't want another thing at all.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Buddy Case? Y'all like Buddy? From Enola, Arkansas, Buddy Case is the 2009 runner-up national champion in Merle Travis's national competition fingerstyle guitar, and 2014 winner of the songwriting competition in Winfield, Kansas. More can be found at Reverb Nation, Facebook, and BuddyCase.com. All right, well, welcome to Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. We are on location at the Faulkner County Library in beautiful downtown Conway, Arkansas. Tales from the South is presented by Temenos Publishing Company and the Midnight Muse Writing Workshops, and I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. What do y'all think about our set back here? Y'all like our set? These Delta screen doors with mixed media portraiture by esteemed Arkansas artist V.L. Cox from her Images of the American South collection and are for sale. A portion of the proceeds from the sale of these works goes to Tales from the South. Our listeners can find out more about these pieces and VL at her website, greatfineart.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Tonight, our stories center around strong women, the mothers, grandmothers, great-grandmothers, and great-aunts who stand up for what is right and teach our storytellers by example. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who lived them. Later tonight, Alicia Francis learns about love and loss through the strong women of her family. And we'll end the night with Nancy Allen and her mother, who isn't going to back down. But let's start the night here at Tales from the South with Polly Abbott Backer, some unruly cousins, and her grandmother, who knows how to take care of business in the Butterfly Bush.
On the north side of our cozy log cabin, I saw the wild green bush that grew near a champion walnut tree. We called it a wahoo bush, bitter ash, whose red, heart-shaped berries birds could eat, but which had a paregoric effect on humans. Springtime brought blooms, which attracted the most beautiful monarchs. One after another, they would flutter to the bush, their magnificent colors reflected in the sunlight, and their bodies waving with the wind. Hundreds came descending from the sky in stair steps as they arrived from their winter Mexican journey, tired, hungry, but brimming with life. My hands tingled as a few lighted on them to my delight and joy. My hair shone in the light as they crowned it with glory. I was not afraid of them. I adored them and rejoiced in their annual, predictable trip. Each year, I mark the days of my calendar, waiting for their wonderful return. My cousins, Monroe and Andrew, had come down from the bluff to visit my uncles, George and Lawrence, all being the same age and having like interests. Monroe and Andrew, rowdy, mean, trick-playing, sneaky relatives, were not my favorite people. They would come in the middle of the night, slithering like snakes from below, smiling and smirking as they turned over the outhouse. Their day trick was to put chicken poop in a sack on the front stoop and light it. George would race out to stomp it, then regret the move and spend hours cleaning the step, his shoe, and his pride. Aunt Helen, a rather large, mean old woman, delighted in her son's adventures. She would laugh like a sick hyena when Grandpa explained their latest trick, how mad he was and how he wanted to pinch their heads off and spank them. I was just a few feet away from the bush, the wind blowing happy butterflies, when the boys appeared looking for trouble. They spied the butterfly bush in all its glory, with the vertical angels flying in and out. They peered at each other, and their conquest was decided without a single word being spoken. Their victims would be shown no mercy. The mulberry limbs would be the death weapons of choice. They ran straight to the bush where innocent butterflies, poised for rest and food, sat, not knowing the end was near. The boys took the switches, hit the bush, and then as the bodies ascended upward, hit them like softballs to their immediate death. To the ground they would fall, and then for good measure, the boys would step on them and crush them. Up and down, up and down. It continued until all were dead and grounded. Then the boys pranced around with sticks over their proud heads. They had killed, enjoyed it, and were celebrating. The horror of this made me sick to my stomach, and I almost fainted. I collapsed into a puddle of sorrow and despair. There had not been enough time to call on a higher power for help. Tears streamed from my eyes, grief from my mouth, and my body was racked with pain and agony. How could they do this? Calmness came as a warm, gentle breeze lifted the dead, limp bodies upward in a whirlwind of sadness, God's tribute. I picked up as many beauties as possible to put in my birthday journal that I had been saving for a special notation. Honor would be paid to my friends, gone but not forgotten. More would come next spring, but they would not be as precious as these. My grief was only relieved by the intense hatred I felt due to the senseless murders. I prayed for revenge, and it came quickly, painfully, and in a timely way. When terrible things happen, God steps in and takes control, and all is well. My grandmother had been watching the shenanigans with horror, disbelief, and compassion. She saw my suffering and was moved to action. She had but one thought, the hurrah bush. It was used for corporal punishment. If there ever had been a crime to merit its use, this was it. She put her large hands on her huge hips and told me what to do using her glaring eyes without a word being spoken. I immediately tore a long, strong, painful whip from the bush. Grandma had been riled and somebody was going to pay. Monroe and Andrew's eyes were as large as the saucers that we put on the supper table. Surely she wouldn't hit them with that stick. They were only boys being boys, and those old butterflies weren't worth anything. Their shoulders were defiant, and they smirked at Grandma. This did not help the situation at all, and really revealed their stupidity. She ran towards them and used her large hands to lift them up and then down to the ground. By this time, the family had heard the noise and came out to witness and cheer. The boys began to see that this was going to happen, and they yelled, screamed, and wiggled as Grandma hit their legs with the switch in the same way they had hit the poor butterflies. Even old Yeller, our dog, who slept under our table, crept out to see what was happening. The boys' high-pitched sounds hurt his ears, and he began to howl. What a sight and what a sound as the family cheered. The boys received their comeuppance. Such behavior needed to be nipped in the bud, and it was. Aunt Helen was coming for a visit and to brag about her money and good fortune and her adoring sons. As she ran to the corner, she saw and heard Grandma, the family, old Yeller. The boys were in a whirlwind of punishment. She was not happy. Her red, ugly face showed despair. She went to the boys and lifted them up like I had done with my dead beauties. She puffed up like one of our barnyard hens and said she would never return to our place. Grandpa said she had her nose out of joint, whatever that meant. I did not look at her nose, but it didn't look so good earlier. A smile appeared on my face, and a burden had been lifted from my head. The day ended with the gently cooling breeze assuring us that all would be well. I was happy knowing that I would not see them again, at least for a long time, and that was fine with me. Things have a way of working themselves out if we sit back and let it. My family talked about this story for a long time. I thought about it each year when it was time for the butterflies to return to their bush. New flying friends returned. However, they were never as beautiful or as graceful as the ones who gave their lives so that two selfish, mean boys could celebrate, if only for a moment.
Polly Abbott Backer is a retired school teacher who writes poetry and short stories. The Butterfly Bush is a story from her collection entitled A Year in the Life of a Southern Girl, which is based on her grandmother's memoir. She lives in Conway, Arkansas. Next on Tales from the South, Alicia Francis returns home to say goodbye to one of three matriarchs in Backyard Elegy.
I am reluctant to return home, but as you do when people die, you go because you don't have a choice. When someone's fabric is torn away from the tapestry of your life, it leaves at least one frayed edge. That's the way I feel about the loss of my Nana, my 100-year-old great-grandma who was the queen matriarch of our family, the one who, up until this point, embroidered us all together. My mother steps out onto the porch when she sees me pull into the driveway. She greets me with a silent hug, and she begins to usher me inside Nana's house. Only, I can't go in yet. I'm not ready. "I'm just going to take a walk for a minute, Mom. I'll come in a few." She nods and walks up the steps and goes inside, where I'm sure there are many casseroles and desserts waiting on us to devour. Nothing says grief like food. I walk around to the backyard. As I stand at the eastern edge of the property and look westward, I have a great vantage point of this one continuous strip of land that's actually comprised of five separate properties, all belonging to various members of our family. This view. I love this view. This used to be where I would go to feel safe, secure, and hopeful in the face of obstacles and uncertainty. A flood of memories so stark and current suddenly overwhelms me, and it's hard to separate past and present. And suddenly, I'm 5 years old again. Over beyond those trees, I can see my great-papa Homer, my Nana's husband, coming across the field, his striped denim overalls permanently stained with the joys of gardening and shelling and fishing. Toodles, his teacup chihuahua, is nestled in his front pocket where she is undisturbed by his lumbering stride. Arms swaying like a giant, slightly askew pendulum, he makes it difficult to notice the earthy stains that cement the creases in his hands from the garden he's been working all day. His leathery neck is glistening with sweat, and his barrel-like fingers gently find his handkerchief and wipe his forehead dry. He walks by me with a wink and a smile. He smells like sweat and earth and fish. The now me wishes the then me could wrap my minuscule arms around his worn neck and thank him for teaching me about beekeeping and fishing and shelling before cancer takes him away in 2 short years. I wish I could say, "Let me write down your bear stories before I get too old and can't remember them anymore." Just beyond that fence, I can see my great Aunt Emma tending to her garden, pulling the tiniest weed from the base of a corn stalk. She doesn't have her teeth in today, but she smiles just the same. Aunt Emma turns around to see Great Uncle Kenneth coming from the pond with a couple fish in hand, and now it seems she's got dinner to prepare. She sighs and spits her tobacco into a heap of paper towels stuffed inside a silver can with a label torn off. I wonder if the then me would have the courage to tell her what the now me knows, that she will die because of what's in that tin can. But she's too busy raising her grandchildren to take notice of me today. Just past that hill, I can see my great Aunt Nona fidgeting with nothing, talking to herself and mumbling words like damn and hell. My 5-year-old ears are scandalized. She stands there, hands in pockets, shoulders at an awkwardly forward hunch. Her wiry gray hair splays around her head like a dandelion. Her personality is just as delicate. She picks up a pair of scissors and begins cutting the grass. My intuition tells me that she should not have access to scissors, so I'll walk over and take them from her. She doesn't resist. I wish the then me could tell her that the now me would still love her even though she has schizophrenia and has to be institutionalized, and it's not her fault that she's a danger to herself. I'm not sure I buy that, though. The only things that are in danger are the naturals and sharps on her upright piano. She'll tear that up like nobody's business. Right beneath that oak tree, I can see Nana sitting in the shade in her favorite metal lawn chair. She's wearing an avocado green cotton dress and a paisley patterned apron, and her hair is curled, not a single strand out of place. She has an aluminum washing basin, full of shelled purple hull peas to her right, and to her left is a white bucket full of fresh from the garden unshelled pea pods. The tips of her fingers are a beautiful shade of eggplant, and she hums a hymn to herself as she diligently shells the peas for dinner. She knows my favorite part of this process is washing the peas, so she asks me if I'm ready to help. I run over and pick up the basin and take it over to the faucet on the side of the house, and the cold water catches my breath as I allow it to run over my grimy hands before letting it run into the peas in the basin. "That's Nana's girl," she says. "When I was a little girl, my mama didn't want little kids tending to the food. In fact, she didn't like kids too much." I look up at her as she pops one end of the pod, slides the peas out, and lets them fall into their places in the basin. She tosses the empty pod to the side. "Some people my age don't even like children. They say our future is doomed because there are more and more Republicans and people putting their money in banks. But I don't think we're doomed. I have faith in you, Leisha, because I'm 100% for the young people." I don't really understand what a Republican is or what it has to do with banks and peas. So I just listen to her as her conversation switches over to more humming, and I'm filled with a peace. I'm happy and at home in her presence. I wish the then me could tell her that the now me is so grateful for the 34 additional years we had together. How honored I am to have been beside her as she took her last breath. How thankful I am that she had faith in me for 39 years, even when she didn't recognize me or remember my name near the end. I wish the now me could tell her that I hope I never disappointed her or made her regret her faith in the young people. Near the clothesline, I notice my grandma, Mamaw Gail. She's been inside taking care of my Papaw Faber, her husband, who's been slowly disappearing from life inside a bedroom in their house. It's stuffy in there, and it smells like the finality of cancer. Mamaw comes out for air, and I'm so happy to see her, I run and plow straight into her. She lets out a grunt, but she's smiling at me. I can see the hard years written across her face, but she's the most beautiful woman my young eyes have ever seen. Her thick white hair is bound by a bandana placed around her hairline to keep the sweat from rolling down into her worn eyes. She looks around the backyard as I watch her face, my hand firmly inside hers. "What you looking at, Mamaw?" I ask, my grin taking over my entire face. She responds in a tired voice, too old sounding to be coming from a 46-year-old woman. "Well, Leisha, I reckon I'm just looking at this beautiful world God created." I look around the backyard and I see my family and the garden and the pond and the fence and the hill and the trees. "Yep," I reply. The now me is honored that my then 5-year-old hand has had the privilege of holding hers for the rest of my 34 years. We're still counting. There's a lot of backyard living we still have to do. I snap back into reality and find that I'm still standing at the easternmost edge of the property behind my Nana's house. I'm filled with such gratitude for the life I've lived here, a life made possible by her. My current home is not too far away from my childhood home, but when I come back, I'm transported back to a time when life was easy, where the people who loved me first were gathered in one location, which made loving each other easier and sometimes harder. But we had each other, and we had this space, and I cannot imagine a place more extraordinary. I'm ready to go inside now.
Alicia Francis is an instructional facilitator at Conway Junior High. She resides in Conway with her beautiful family. Alicia grew up in Greenbrier, Arkansas, where she lived with a unified trio of matriarchs who taught her everything she knows. In our final story of the night here at Tales from the South, Nancy Allen is told she can't do something, but her mother is having none of that in Taking on a Dragon.
One Friday after school, when I was 12, I walked to the community library, found a book on the shelf, and went to the desk to check it out. I pulled out my library card and presented it to one of the pearl and cardigan-clad ladies, along with several other nondescript books of my choice. She opened and stamped, opened and stamped, opened and stamped, and then came to a sudden halt. She peered at me from over tortoiseshell reading glasses, giving me a fairly stern once over. "I'm sorry," said she, "but I'm not sure this book is appropriate for someone your age." And so that was that. I was a good little girl, and when a grown-up said something like that to me, I was always in the mood to listen. But I went home that evening feeling kind of sad. I told my mom about my misadventure, just table talk, you know. To my utter and complete surprise, the crusader in her awoke. "No one is going to tell my child what she can and cannot read. There is not a book in print that is outside of her scope and comprehension, and she has the maturity to handle any kind of subject matter." When I asked her what was wrong with the subject matter at hand, she paused a moment and then said, "It is a pretty adult story, but I think it is wrong to protect children from adult content, especially when it is a part of classic literature." She was frustrated that it was a Friday evening and that the library would be closed all weekend. She was ready to take on a dragon that evening and walked through the house practicing, in varying tones, the withering things she would say to the hapless ladies in lace collars who were volunteering their time at that little library. If there were such a thing as cosmic justice, my mother would have been born a Southerner, a Southern lady, to be sure. She, the mom on the block who never left the house without hat and gloves, who made sure that her children played indoors on hot summer days, who taught her daughter to curtsy when presented to guests, the mom who dressed to go to the market, who entertained with forks and water goblets just so on a perfectly appointed table, who knew every Jell-O salad recipe conceived since Fanny Farmer was a girl. But no, my mother was born in the Midwest of German parentage, but she would have excelled in all things Southern if grace, style, charm, and a certain steely-eyed force of will were the sole criteria. In some respects, however, she missed the grade. When my Uncle Ray went into the North Woods and came home with his deer, my mother declined to cook it on the grounds that such fare smacked of victuals, and that was not the sort of message she wanted to send to her family. She disparaged the greens and cornbread that the lady who did for our family would cook for us kids at lunchtime, however much we adored it. She did not advise me to watch Hee Haw, Beverly Hillbillies, or saints forbid, the Dukes of Hazzard, for fear that my budding princess sensibilities would be forever tainted by the contact. When I was in the sixth grade, in a new school, the other girls in my grade were beginning to poke out in the chest region, while my silhouette still resembled that of a well-fed penguin. When it was time to choose teams, I ended up in the outfield, usually with a book in my pocket, since I knew I would be safe from any spherical intrusions. My elementary school was close to the junior high school, with its fully equipped auditorium, athletic field, field house, and bleachers. The popular kids would hang out behind the bleachers after school, smoking, maybe drinking a beer supplied by high schoolers, and generally practicing activities that would ensure the existence of a future generation in our little town. I would walk past those bleachers on my way to the little gray-painted building that served as the community library, my refuge, staffed by kindly volunteer ladies who smelled of violets and taboo. I started with the A's and fell in love with Little Women. I would later describe my personal compass as something like Victorian Zen, the product of reading Louisa May Alcott and Mary Baker Eddy all together one summer. Of course, I didn't read every author in the alphabetical list. Somehow, even then, Louis L'Amour couldn't quite trump Trollope, Dickens, or Austen. So I moved fairly quickly through the list. It was a fairly small library, and I had my favorites, so soon enough I reached the H's and Nathaniel Hawthorne. I thought I had the chops for it, so that's when I went to check out The Scarlet Letter, was told I couldn't, and put my mother on a mission to ensure that I could read whatever I darn well pleased. Monday brought no abatement of her zeal. Perfectly coiffed, with hat in place, white gloves smoothed over beringed hands, a handbag dangling daintily from one wrist, she descended on the library, breathing fire. Unfortunately, I was at school, so was not a witness to the confrontation, which, according to my mother, left one volunteer near tears, and the director inadequately murmuring about readability and sixth-grade vocabularies. She came to my school, had me brought out of class to the principal's office, and there instructed me to go to the library that afternoon and check out the book which was being held for me at the front desk. And so I did, and bore in triumph the book of the hour, The Scarlet Letter. I didn't go straight home. I thought I might be allowed to join the ranks of the cool kids under the bleachers if I was reading a book deemed unsafe for a 12-year-old girl. I found a likely place and curled up, preparing to enjoy the forbidden story. It began, a throng of bearded men in sad colored garments and gray steeple-crowned hats, intermixed with women, some wearing hoods and other bareheaded, was assembled in front of a wooden edifice, the door of which was heavily timbered with oak and studded with iron spikes. Ah, yes, here was my story. I read under the bleachers, where I was left strictly alone. Evidently, challenging a real librarian was not the key to social redemption. I read in the bathtub. I read in bed. I read all weekend. I mourned the poor taste of Mr. Hawthorne in naming his heroine Hester. I wondered at poor Hester falling in love with the entirely wimped-out Arthur Dimmesdale. Ha! Dimmesdale, the name says it all. I labored with her in the creation of the beautiful bodice with its glorious letter A, and I adored Pearl, she of great price, with her wildness and isolation and fervent imagination. I loved it all, and I took the book back to the library the following week, laying it on the return desk with a little superior smirk. "Did you enjoy it? Did you understand it?" asked the gentle lady behind the vase of posies. I nodded yes to both questions and went off to find some Victoria Holt to rest my disordered mind. It was not until many years later that I finally understood what the letter A actually meant.
Nancy Allen is the Adult Services and Reference Librarian at the Faulkner County Library. She lives with her husband in a haunted house that has been in the family for six generations. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers. Thank you to our live audience here at the Faulkner County Library. And thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by Temenos Publishing Company and the Midnight Muse Writing Workshops. And tonight's show is in conjunction with the 2015 Conway Arts Fest. Additional support provided by UALR School of Mass Communications, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, Little Rock Soiree Magazine, UALR's Department of Rhetoric and Writing, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Arkansas Arts Council, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. We are open for submissions from all Southerners. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations for Tales from the South provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast in Little Rock. More at robinwoodbnb.com. And the Baker House Bed and Breakfast in North Little Rock. More at bakerhouseNLR.com. Live sound and studio assistance provided by the UALR School of Mass Communication. You too can experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. We're now traveling throughout Arkansas and the South, bringing Tales to your community. Details on hosting a live show, our schedule, and ticket information can all be found on our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for keeping the art of Southern-style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week on Tales from the South.
Well, a vulture needs the roadside. A politician needs his tongue tied. A doctor needs a sharp knife and a little bit of gall. A preacher needs an audience. A hermit needs some confidence. A baker needs a little dough. And a fly just needs a wall. And I need you to need me like summer needs the fall. When you need me like I need you, I won't need another thing at all. Boy wants a deep fry. A gator wants the summer rain when it's dry in his abode. Well, a piggy wants to waller. A hound dog wants to holler. Armadillos want someone to get. Armadillos want someone to teach them how to cross the road. And I want you to want me like songbirds want to call. And when you want me like I want you, I won't want another thing at all. No, no, I won't want another thing at all.